Ladies and gentlemen, we need to make Mr. Anderson feel right at home. So we're going to do a countdown from 10 to bring him up to the stage. And then I want to hear the biggest cheer you've ever done in your life so they can hear it from space. But let's start that countdown. 10, 9, everybody, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, let's hear it really loud, really loud.
I'm from the U.S. government, and I'm here to help you. Tara, thanks for that introduction. I have one question. What is it with Christians in that you can't have a prayer lunch or a prayer dinner? It has to be a prayer breakfast, and I have to get up at 5 in the morning to come over here? I mean, you know, as a former government employee, I'm in bed till noon, so... I'm not quite sure how to do this today. First of all, I've actually never been asked to give a testimony. That's not the hard part for me. It's just how to present it to you. I'm a big storyteller. I love to tell stories. I have a million of them. And that's how I'm going to approach this today. You know, I talked to Ashley this morning. I got to meet my new friend Ashley, and she was tremendously disappointed this morning in that I didn't come in and my blue flight suit with polished boots. You know, I'm not buff anymore. If I ever was buff, I don't know. But if you wear a flight suit, any military in here? Raise your hand if you're military, right? What do you call a flight suit? What'd you call it? You call it the bag? You used to wear your bag, right? And if I put on my bag today, it would look like it was filled with some watermelons, right? Because I don't have those great abs that I used to have when I was younger. So, you know, Ashley just seemed so disappointed. But what I tried to explain to her was that wearing the bag would be difficult for me at age 64. And I've come up with this little pullover thing, right? It's my own design. I reached out to Lands' End Business Outfitters. I got the right color. I got the quarter zip pull up, right? I went to Ellington Field in Houston, Texas, and I said, hey guys, in the flight crew equipment shop, can you sew on all the patches and all the stuff to make it look like my flight suit? And they helped me out. And so today I want to introduce you to what they call now the half astronaut flight suit. So. I wasn't sure if you could tell that story at a prayer breakfast, but... So, my remarks today, typically I would be able to show you some pictures of Earth, right? Because I think most of you will understand that the privilege of going to outer space and being 240 miles above our planet gives us a nice, different look. And what NASA wants astronauts to do, in my experience, they don't like you to talk about your faith. They want you to talk more scientifically, more appropriately for their government bureaucracy focus. And they want me to talk about what we would call as astronauts the orbital perspective. Now, the orbital perspective is simply a phrase that says we get the privilege to see our planet from a different vantage point, a different perspective. And that's important, and I get it, right? I looked at our Earth every single day, and I saw that we were all crewmates on Spaceship Earth. And as I looked at our planet, I saw how fragile it can be, that thin line of atmosphere, you know, a basketball with a quarter millimeter thickness around it would represent the thinness of the atmosphere of our planet. And so it's something we must protect. We're all on Spaceship Earth. We're traveling together, every single human being on the planet. But NASA wants us to give that perspective. Well, I'm here today. I want to tell you a few stories that give you my perspective. Because as Nebraska's first and hopefully not only astronaut, it's important to me that you understand what it meant to me. And to do that, I need to apologize in advance that I may get emotional when I tell some of these stories. They're very important to me. And the first one I would tell you has to do with the Columbia crew. I was a baby astronaut, pretty much. I hadn't done anything in the office. I hadn't flown in space yet. I'd been trained a little bit, right? I've been through the astronaut basic training. They had given me a job to work on the space station electrical power system. My mentor in that system was a young lady named Casey Chavla. And Casey Chavla would end up on the Columbia, the STS-107 crew. And unbeknownst to me, I would get a phone call one day from the commander of that crew, Rick Husband. Well, Rick was a real astronaut. He'd flown in space already. He was a military guy, an Air Force fighter pilot, and a Christian. And for some reason, he called me that day, and he said, "Hey, Clay, this is Rick. How you doing?" And I said, "Hey, I'm fine." And I'm thinking, why the heck are you calling me? What have I done? I usually didn't get calls unless I'd messed up, right? And he asked me to be a family escort for the STS-107 crew. Well, I thought that was cool. Had no idea what it meant, but I thought it was cool. Yeah, we have a document that you can read, how to be a family escort. It's a government document. I didn't read it. But I was with Steve Lindsay, a veteran astronaut, a flown shuttle commander who'd been a family escort before. I'd never done it before. I was with Scott Perezinski, another astronaut who'd been a family escort. I was with Terry Virts, another rookie who had not. But between the four of us, we were in charge of taking care of the families during the pre-mission, the post, all that. And I would end up in Florida in our first meeting with the FBI. Because Elon Ramon, Israeli's first astronaut, was a member of the 107 crew. And as we sat in this room with FBI agents and then walked out to understand the ramifications of the possibility of a terrorist act against an Israeli astronaut, you know, all this stuff kind of, did I really want to be a family escort? But as I pushed their kids in the swing and I chased Elon's daughter Noah down the slide, and I ran to get donuts and move their luggage as I needed to, I became part of that family. And on the rooftop, on the LCC, on the day they launched, I was pretty nervous. Because launch day is the day we lost the Challenger. And as we stood on the roof with all those families, and I watched them go into space, and I heard those various calls, I was aware of what could happen. But fortunately, nothing did. We would make it through the mission. I would bring Steve Green, the Christian singer, to the Johnson Space Center. I would give him a tour of the whole place for Evelyn and Rick Husband because they were really close friends. And I would find myself at the Kennedy Space Center on landing day in February of 2003. And all the families were there. It was a beautiful day. The kids were throwing frisbees and running around in the grass. And I'm standing there talking to Laurel Clark's sister. Laurel Clark was another member of the crew. And I remember as I stood there, we were listening to the audio that was going on. The countdown clock was right there, a big old clock ticking down. We were waiting for the two sonic booms of the shuttle nose and the shuttle wake, right? Boom, boom. But as I looked and chatted, I saw a security guard against the snow fence that separated the family area from the VIPs. She was dressed in a blue blazer, a white shirt, and gray slacks. And she had one of those big old walkie-talkies. And I watched her raise it to her ear, and her face then went white. It was at that moment I knew that I would have to call on my faith in God more than I'd ever relied on it in my life. It would turn out that that was a really rotten day. And I didn't know why I was there. But it was a Saturday, and when I finally got home to Houston that night and saw my wife and my son, who was 10, or no, he was 6, I'm sorry, he was 6, and he was hugging his mom's leg, and I walked in the door, and I hugged them both, and my son looked up to me, and he said, "Dad, did they die?" "Yeah, son, they did." "Did they have children, Dad?" "Yep, they did." "Did I know their children?" "Yes, son, you did." He let go of his mom, and he turned, and he walked away. I told my wife, Susan, that I had to be in church the next morning. I didn't know if I could take it, but I had to be there. And of course, the church at Webster Presbyterian in Webster, Texas, there were reporters all over the place. We were the church of the astronauts, where John Glenn and Buzz Aldrin and several others had grown up in their faith when they first came to the Houston area. And I went to Sunday school, and Pastor Woody Berry was giving his message, and I broke down. And some of the people from our church in the class, as I cried, put their hand on my shoulder and said, "We can't think of anyone better than you to be there to represent God to those families." If you fast forward a few years, I would find myself in Moscow, Russia, for the very first time in February. Not a good time to go to Moscow. I got off the airplane and I hopped in a van with a little man named Efim who only spoke Russian. And Efim, in the middle of the night, it seemed like it was so dark, right? It was probably 7 o'clock at night, but in the wintertime in Russia, it's been dark for days. And we drove northeast of Moscow to get to Star City, Russia, where I would train with the cosmonauts to fly on the International Space Station. As we drove across an intersection, we had to slow down and swerve because there was a dead body in the middle of the intersection with a Russian military officer and an AK submachine gun, not a semi-automatic look-alike, but a real machine gun standing over the dead body. Whoa. I got to my cottage, put my stuff away. I had to go try to go to sleep that night and wake up to get up in the morning to go into Star City for my first day of training. I was scared. I didn't know what was coming. I didn't know if I could do it. And I was pretty depressed. As I made it through the first couple of weeks, my current commander at the time was an astronaut named Jeff Williams, and Jeff just spoke at my museum a couple days ago about faith. And Jeff decided that we should all go into Moscow to a place called the Tretiakov Art Gallery. And as we got into this huge art gallery, we broke up and we went our separate ways for a while. And I ended up walking through a door. I had no idea where I was. And I walked through a door and I turned to my left. And there on the wall, about 12 foot high, in a huge gold ornate frame, was a picture painted by Ivan Kramskoy, a Russian. And this artist called his piece Christos na Pustinia, Christ in the Wilderness. I stood in front of that painting for almost 25 minutes. I looked at every single detail. Christ was tall. He was skinny. His fingernails were about that long. He had a drape around his waist, and that was it. His feet were placed on the rocks. He sat on a stone with his chin in his hand with the most forlorn and sad expression I'd ever seen. As I stared at that painting, all I could think of was, if he could do that for me, I can surely do this. It would get better. It was not as tumultuous as I might have expected until I ended up at the Kennedy Space Center in June of 2007. That was the day of my first launch. And the day prior to that, we get the opportunity as a crew to walk the pad with our spouse. And my wife, Susan, showed up at crew quarters. We were all excited. She looked so beautiful. She had on khaki shorts. She had a red tank top and a red sweater with our symbol from the mission patch adorned on her clothing. And we went out to the pad for a tour. You start at the bottom level. You hop in the elevator and go to the 195-foot level. We were walking around the pad because you have to see a couple things, right? You have to look at the big yellow arrows, the point you toward the escape pod in case the shuttle begins to do something it's not supposed to do. And I pointed all that out to her and told her about the training. We didn't talk too much because it was a pretty anxiety-filled day. And of course, we walked around and saw the bathroom, the 195-foot bathroom, the next to last chance you have to do number one or number two before you fly into space. The final choice, if you miss that one, is what NASA would label the maximum absorbency garment, otherwise known as a diaper. But I held Susan's hand very tightly because I knew what was coming the next day. And as we stood in front of the shuttle at about the same height as the commander's window, I wasn't quite sure what to say to her because I was pretty scared, not about flying in space, but about never having the opportunity to hold her hand again. And as we stood there looking in each other's eyes, mine began to tear up, and then we got a visit from a butterfly. And that butterfly flew around my head. We both looked at each other, and I said, "You know what? I bet that's my dad, who had died in 1984. And he was there to fly around my head, a gift from God to tell me that it was going to be okay." We both smiled, we hugged, and we continued on our journey up to the very top of the launch pad, over 200 feet above the Florida coast. And as we stood just close enough to touch the top of the orange external tank, that little point that sits on the top, here came that butterfly one more time. And he flew around both of us. And we're thinking, holy cow, I didn't know butterflies could fly that high. Right? Down in Moody Garden in Galveston, they're all low to the ground. But the hardest part, and I'll close with this last story. On June the 8th, 2007, I was to launch on board the Space Shuttle Atlantis to the International Space Station. June the 8th would have been my father's 77th birthday. I was launching on the crew of STS-117. My parking space as an astronaut at the Johnson Space Center was 117. I would launch on Atlantis to become a member of the Expedition 15 crew. I applied to be an astronaut and wasn't selected until my 15th try. If you write Clayton Anderson on a piece of paper and count the letters, you'll get the number 15. And when I flew my second mission with STS-131, which, by the way, I was in space 13 years ago today, prepping to do my fourth spacewalk tomorrow in orbit, that mission lasted 15 days. So I would make it to space. Everything was cool. We docked. The STS-117 crew, six type A astronauts who didn't need me, the sack of potatoes. They called me SOP, sack of potatoes. They threw me across the hatch and told me, have a great space station mission, right? Everything went well. We did some EVAs. We prepped the station. My head was exploding because of all the things I had to learn. But it was cool. I was weightless. I was Superman. I was flying in space. And when they got time to leave, the STS-117 crew passed with the commander, the Marine first, the pilot second, mission specialist two third, all in order, right? He's a Marine, for God's sake. The last guy, Danny Olivas, he looks at me. We're floating in front of the hatch. Danny was a classmate of mine from 1998. Danny looks me in the eye. He shakes my hand and he says, "Man, am I glad I'm not you." And he flies through the hatch. 20 minutes later, I look out the lab window, and I watch the Space Shuttle Atlantis slowly pass underneath the space station on its way back to Earth. I had a big feeling in the pit of my stomach. but I would make it. And I would also know that the 117 crew would come home, and they're supposed to land at the Kennedy Space Center, but weather was bad, and they landed at Edwards Air Force Base in California. They took the shuttle off the runway, stacked it on a shuttle carrier aircraft, which is a big 747, and they have to get that 747 from California back to Florida. And they usually do it in two legs because they need to stop for fuel. They have to check the route. They want to know that the weather's good where they're going. They don't want a lot of traffic around. And they want to make it safe. Well, in June of 2007, that SCA with the Space Shuttle Atlantis made that stop at a place called Offutt Air Force Base. And before they landed at Offutt Air Force Base, they fly three big circles around the landing site so that people just like you can get outside and you can see the amazing shuttle, the amazing carrier aircraft, and the vehicle that took Nebraska's first and only astronaut to outer space. Fast forward to October, STS-120 on Discovery is scheduled to launch and bring me home. They launched successfully. Every single thing that launched during my time in space, every single thing was always exactly on time. And Discovery arrived and they docked, and I was so excited because now it was time to go home. And we had about an 8 to 10 day mission. They did three EVAs, three spacewalks. Everything was good. We were all rocking and rolling. But we had a big problem with a tear in a solar array. And I don't know how many people might remember it, but it was a very dangerous spacewalk to connect the shuttle arm to another arm to reach the astronaut all the way to the solar array, where we could do these little clever cufflinks that were designed by the guys on the ground to tie that solar array together and unfurl it its entire way and save the day. Typical NASA. But Pam Melroy, the commander of Discovery, she got on the horn and she said, you know, we're scheduled to land at night. And is there any way we can change our trajectory a little bit so that we can have a daylight landing? We're all pretty exhausted here. Well, they hadn't given a daylight landing okay since before Columbia. And the folks on the ground talked and they decided that it's okay. We're going to change your trajectory. We're going to make it so that you're going to have a daylight landing at the Kennedy Space Center. And as we came home that day, we did our deorbit burn, and we have all that energy, 17,500 miles per hour, that has to get down to 200 miles per hour so that the shuttle can land on the runway. Well, the way we do it is what we call roll reversals. And a roll reversal is simply a maneuver by the shuttle to go back and forth against the atmosphere, just like you might take a rock and go to the lake and throw it and skip it, right? It has a certain velocity. It skips the first time and slows down, the second time, the third time, the fourth time, and then eventually, it dives into the water. Same idea, different medium, right? The shuttle against the atmosphere. We're coming in over Washington State, headed for Florida. And Pam Melroy gets on the horn and she says, Houston, Discovery on Air to Ground 1. We're getting ready to start our first roll reversal over the great state of Nebraska. I didn't ask her to say that. I didn't expect her to say that. She said that because she knew how much this place means to me. So we're screaming in. We're heading to Florida. We're crossing over the west side of the Florida Peninsula. We're going to do a big Hiaca turn around the heading alignment cone, and we're going to come in, and we're going to land on runway 1533. When we touch down and roll to a stop, and Commander Melroy said, Houston, Discovery, we'll stop. We had landed on November 7th, 2007. If you write November 7 as a digital number, it is 117. And that day, November 7th, 2007, would be Susan and my 15th wedding anniversary. So if you don't believe there's a power greater than us, someone who watches over and looks for the example that's needed in the world today, then you and I need to have a talk outside in the hall. I'm nothing special. I'm a small town kid from Ashland, Nebraska. But I believe that I'm here for a reason. I gave up 42 years in Houston with my wife to sell our house and move to a two-bedroom apartment in Gretna. I thought astronauts were supposed to be smart. But the museum that I now am the president and CEO of is built on land that I climbed on as a kid, as a Cub Scout, as a Boy Scout. The doors to that museum opened in May of 1998, 1 month before NASA would select me to become Nebraska's first and only astronaut. That museum is about 3.5 miles from where I grew up. The new mayor of Ashland's my uncle. My brother Kirby and his family live in Benson. My sister Lori and her husband Phil live in Aurora. And my oldest son, Cole, and his new wife, Mary Kate, live in Omaha because Mary Kate just got residency assignment at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. So if you go back to the original phrase, for me, it's God, family, and then astronaut. And I believe with all my heart that I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to have come home. I have a job to do. I don't believe in failure, but I cannot do it alone. None of us can do it alone. We need each other, but we also need faith. I don't quote Bible scriptures very much, right? As a kid, I knew John 3:16, for God so loved the world that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. But the other one I like, maybe even better, because of my God family astronaut, is Proverbs 22:6. And I'll paraphrase, raise your kids the right way. And if you raise your kids the right way, when they get older, they won't stray from that way. And so we, in this room, have the power to change lives. With your kids, your grandkids, your nieces, your nephews, your brothers and sisters, your Bible study, your PTA, your Chamber of Commerce, we have the power to change lives. But I would challenge you to put faith first and always make it God, family, astronaut. Thanks for having me this morning. I appreciate you. God bless you all. Go Big Red.